It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Wacomico County will be 150 years old, and local officials and residents are celebrating. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In 1608, the famous John Smith sailed up the Nanticoke and Wacomico Rivers. British soldiers and settlers began arriving under land grants from Lord Baltimore, and the rivers were key transportation conduits with the town of Salisbury, which was incorporated in 1854. The region itself was sympathetic to the Confederate cause, but also produced such likes as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. It was not until after the Civil War in 1867 that Wacomico County was carved out of Somerset and Worcester counties. Salisbury became the seat of the county government. To mark the 150th anniversary, in our studios, we have Dr. Creston Long. He's director of the Knapp Center, and also Zach Evans. He's chair of the Wacomico County Fair. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Chris, I'm going to start with you. And one of the basic questions is, how did it come about that Wacomico County got carved out of these two other counties? What were the political and economic dynamics there?
Okay. Well, there's several things. It's 1867. So I want to point out that's just a couple of years after the end of the American Civil War. So really, this is a time in which the country is recovering from that. The center portion of the peninsula, so this area where we're southern Delaware through what was then Somerset and Worcester County, that had continued to grow and expand economically in the previous few decades. So remarkably, through the Civil War, there had been an expansion of the railroad into this portion of the peninsula from northern Delaware. Right on the eve of the Civil War, about 1860, it stopped at the Delaware state line. And, that year it extended down to Salisbury. By the end of the war and the creation of Wacomico County, it had extended down through Somerset and Worcester County towards Pocomoke City. So the extension of that railroad really allowed this area to connect in with much larger markets to the north and to the west. The major metropolitan areas of Philadelphia, New York, Baltimore, Wilmington, combined with the modernization of the United States because of the Civil War, that brought this area to an interesting time, economically speaking. So we've got a city of Salisbury that was essentially and literally divided between two counties, Worcester County to the east, and Somerset County on the west side. And what we know as Division Street today, that was literally the dividing line between the two counties. But right in the center of this area was this growing urban area of Salisbury. So it was difficult to conduct business in this growing commercial area if the county courthouses were dozens of miles away. So Snow Hill in the case of Worcester and Princes Anne in the case of Somerset County, to conduct business and to grow, it helps to actually be closer to the county seat. This is a problem that we can see all across the United States when it comes to expansion and the creation of new counties. It's a similar impulse. The desire is to create and subdivide additional counties so that access to land records and the county courthouse to judicial rulings is much closer. So in 1867, there was a new Maryland Constitution that was drafted, and it included language that allowed the subdivision of Wacomico County out of Somerset and Worcester counties. So it's in that year that there was an opportunity to do this, and there was an effort to organize pro-division voters out of this portion of Somerset, this portion of Worcester. They voted, and it was agreed that there would be a new county.
Was that generally the sentiment in the area? Was there any opposition, or was
there,
it really
there was
generally,
some.
What was that about?
Was Yeah. And we have to imagine that, you know, there's a connection to the former county, right? There it could be familial connections. I'm not going to be able to give you precise reasons for this, but if for whatever reason families in the sort of the southern end of Somerset had family connections further south, closer to Princess Anne, this might not have seemed quite as necessary to them, or business connections. So that certainly could be an issue. The counties that were already in existence, Somerset and Worcester, not all of the residents of each county got to vote on this. It was the residents in the portion that would become the new county. Had it been a larger vote, including all voters in both counties, there might have been greater opposition because of loss of tax base, loss of land, that sort of thing. But in the end, it was a fairly healthy majority that in both counties that that led to the subdivision.
So what was this area then like? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the railroad coming in, and obviously that's beginning to transform the region. But at the same time, we note that, that the region itself was still fairly cut off. I mean, obviously, we don't get the bridge until many years later. So but this is still a fairly isolated area.
On the one hand, it was, because we don't see a large what we think of as a modern connection like a railroad. But something I always emphasize is that there was steamboat traffic fairly regularly at this point. And even going back to the colonial period, there was waterbound transportation. There was a network of roads. I wouldn't really call it a system, but there were connections between this area and Philadelphia even during the colonial period. So I don't want to overstate the whole isolation part. It was never total. But certainly the extension of the railroad was going to speed things up quite a bit. During this time, the years leading up to the war and right after, this area was a major agricultural area and timber producer. Timber was becoming a big business in this portion of Delmarva, and a lot of trees that were harvested here and milled were put in buildings in New York City and Philadelphia. That connection, this new connection, the railroad, helped speed up that whole process. The movement of fruits and vegetables directly out of fields onto the streets of New York City, sometimes the very next day, that was enabled by the railroad. So the makings of Salisbury economy were there. They'd been there for decades. Agriculture, timber, the extension of, again, these more modern forms of transportation sped up that process. And then towards the end of the decade, when the railroad was extended down through what remained Somerset County to Crisfield, that started to develop seafood as a major industry. So there was a bit of seafood production here in Salisbury and Wicomico as well.
So what was the cultural atmosphere like? What's the history for the people here? I mean, we talked a little bit about that. They weren't quite so isolated, but there clearly was as you mentioned a moment ago, this is interconnection of a lot of families who've been here a very long time. Mm-hmm. You can even see it today in the roads and the people who certainly occupy political offices and leadership. Their families really stretch back. What kind of culture are we looking at? I mean, obviously, they're also coming out of the slave era, which at least was not dominant, but certainly was present.
Yeah. Well, so again, going into the Civil War, Wicomico doesn't exist as an entity, but Somerset and Worcester counties, there were several thousand slaves in each of those counties going into the war. There was also a sizable free African-American population in both counties, and you don't really find that much farther south of here. That's where Maryland becomes distinctive. If we're looking at the United States in that lead up to the Civil War, Maryland has a substantial free African-American population alongside a substantial and about equally sized enslaved population. So that makes Maryland distinctive in a way. We've got, obviously, there's a reason why there was an enslaved labor force. There was still heavy agriculture here. No cotton production here. People sometimes assume that was all over. That was not the case here.
Or tobacco, for that matter.
Not by that point, certainly. But, you know, clearly agriculture was a major part of that. These influences from Baltimore and Philadelphia shouldn't be forgotten. Maryland was an industrializing state by this time. You don't find that south of here either. That looks more, that has more of a middle Atlantic northern feel to it than, say, North Carolina or South Carolina or many parts of Virginia. It was, culturally, it is hard to pinpoint down that, to really pinpoint that. I know that's unsatisfying for many people. They want it to this was a southern place, or this was not. It was, you know, many immigrants here, and it was more northern. It was a real blend, and that would have been visible in the broader population, not in the voting population at this point. That still would have been incredibly restricted. That was white men. So we shouldn't confuse those two. But influences from metropolitan areas from the north, there was a clear commercial connection between this area and those places, and that would have been a part of people's life here. They would have known that the fruits and vegetables they were growing were heading north. The timber that they were producing, a lot of that was building cities. So I think there would have been a real cultural blend here. Certainly, though, with a southern feel to it at times, and but also a sense of change.
Well, obviously, one of the major industries is the poultry industry. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I've always posed is there any special reason why poultry should have been here in the first place? Obviously, now we've got this entire infrastructure that's now built around it.
Right.
What was the impetus, and why was it so easy, do you think, for poultry to grow? Obviously, much of it centers around the Perdue family, mm-hmm. who is now one of the dominant economic engines, certainly here. How did that develop? Why is it that we seem to be so amenable to it,
right,
and its growth?
Well, that comes about later. That's a 20th right. century phenomenon, and really a couple decades into the 20th century is when poultry production becomes something that is more of an industry and becomes big business here. It starts to emerge then. Yeah, I certainly think that the land itself is amenable to growing food for the chickens. That's clearly a major. The predominant portion of our agriculture goes towards poultry production in one way or another, whether it's raising the chickens themselves or producing feed for them. So certainly, I think the land itself was part of that, but these transportation advances clearly are part of it as well.
So at this point, do you think that there's this distinct difference between what seemed to be the requirements when poultry began, as opposed to, say, now we jump to, say, the 2017, where mm-hmm. we now are much more concerned about the Bay, much more concerned about agriculture and its impact. And there seems to be, as if when it was created or when it was put forth that we should, you know, involve ourselves in poultry, now we're mm-hmm. this sort of 100 years later and we say, well, maybe not so much. I mean, there seems to be a much different, you know, environmental impact than it, say, was even then.
Oh, okay. So, well, I mean, we've seen by this point, over the course of just shy of 100 years, we've seen the relatively slow beginning emergence of the industry, the in some ways, the consolidation of it. And we would have found more smaller chicken producers back several decades ago. And that's generally over the course of the 20th century moved into the hands of a relatively small number of larger companies. And I'd say that's still the predominant model at this point. So I don't think it's anywhere near a point of being in decline, but there are experts who study this far more than I do that could speak better to this than I can.
And what about agriculture in general? Did that change over in terms of what was produced?
Yeah, there are huge differences there. And if we were to look at agricultural census schedules from the late 1800s, what we would notice is that farmers here produced all sorts of produce and grains and potatoes, and there were some that specialized in sheep raising. It was a very diverse place, and that's what would stand out to people. Anyone who pays attention today and drives along Route 50 and looks at the fields, as I hope people do because they're usually beautiful, right? There's something to see there. They would notice it's predominantly soybeans or corn, if they know what they're looking for. 100 years ago, or even much less than that, actually, you would have seen far more vegetable production, fruit orchards. This area where we are right now, there were orchards in the area adjacent to what's now Salisbury University. It was a far different place. I mean, the town just south of us, Fruitland, it takes its name from what was growing on the land. The ability to pick vegetables and fruits, can them right in the area. There were canneries all around this region in the late 1800s through the much of the 20th century. The ability to do that and then pack them to ship across the country, that's what sustained agriculture here for a long time. So it would have looked very different. It would look much more diverse than it is
today. And what kind of, along this line, what kind of impact was there in terms of the watermen, in terms of mm-hmm. crabbing, that kind of thing? Because we're fairly inland in many ways.
True, right? But if we look at a map that was drawn in the late 1870s, of their maps covering the Eastern Shore in this the 1877 Atlas, if we look at Salisbury, there were oyster packing houses right in downtown Salisbury. There were ice houses adjacent to them. So even during that fairly early time, when seafood is really taking off in a big way further south of here in Chrisfield, here in Salisbury and then out on the Nanticoke River, there were fisheries and there were canning operations. And it certainly was a part of the economy here. It really, you're right, though. I mean, we would have to look out a bit closer to the bay to see the real impact of that. But that's the other big economic development in the late 19th century on Delmarva is the explosion, namely of oyster harvesting. And then later in the 20th century, we'd see crabbing emerge.
I want to turn, by the way, one more time to the issue of race, because we obviously had the lynching in 1931 of Matthew Williams. And describe, obviously, the events surrounding that. What do you think drove that kind of thing? What was the status of race relations? And as I think we mentioned before we started the interview, then it really sort of made H.L. Mencken famous because he was an editor of the Baltimore Sun and wrote extensively about this particular issue with very unkind words, I might say, for the Eastern Shore.
Well, it broader historians of American history usually point to the 1920s as one of the low points of race relations in the country. There is, during that decade, a spike in the number of lynchings. It was a horrible period. This is also the decade in which an invigorated Ku Klux Klan was out in the open. I mean, there are famous pictures of rallies on Pennsylvania Avenue, parades. I mean, that was the 1920s. So 1931, early December, is when Matthew Williams was lynched in downtown Salisbury. It had stemmed from an event earlier in the afternoon, a shooting that, one of the things when there's a lynching, there's the death of the victim who's being lynched, but there's also the death of any chance of finding the truth about what really happened. Nothing regarding that initial incident ever went to trial. So we don't know who was responsible for the shooting earlier in the afternoon. That is lost to history. But the lynching occurred that night, again, early December 1931. And then in the couple of days after that, that is when reporting on the lynching went in two very different directions. If we look at local reporting, there was some reporting, but it was rather vague in detail. And then there was reporting developing from outside of the immediate area. And the most famous of that comes from the Baltimore Sun and H.L. Mencken. And from that point on, really, it develops into really a conflict almost over culture. We see virtually no attention to the victim, Matthew Williams, in the reporting. It becomes this war of words between local outlets here and metropolitan papers like the Sun, and it becomes something of a culture war in the early 1930s. Now, there'd be a lynching a couple of years later, 1933, just down in Prince's Anne. So again, it's a period in which was fairly common. And these were the last lynchings in Maryland. But I see it as the back end of that period. And with it, it takes communities a very, very long time to come to grips with that sort of an event.
Because I know, for instance, obviously there's been some debate about having a marker, for instance, to mark where he was lynched, which is outside the courthouse.
Yes.
Being so close and this community being so intertwined in terms of family members. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know some folks have said they may have had family members who actually were at the lynching. Do you think that's one of the reasons why we still have a difficult time, particularly here in Wicomico County, but in general in terms of the Eastern Shore, of coming to grips with the passage because it is so personal.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's difficult for many people to get their minds, first of all, around the brutality of an event like that, just to even imagine it and visualize it, but then to consider that people in maybe a generation or two older were perhaps directly involved, or witnesses were there and watched and did nothing, which, you know, was the case with the crowd. That is a difficult thing. And there have been a number of discussions about commemorating this event or trying to come to grips with it, but it took a very long time to even be able to talk about it.
But finally, turn to the bridge. Some people on the Eastern Shore said it was the worst thing to ever happen. All of us started coming across the bridge. What kind of impact do you think the opening of that bridge, and obviously more and more people coming to the shore, and just in recent years, we've had a lot of retirees who have been coming to the shore. What kind of impact do you think that's been had on the shore, and what kind of future does that mean in terms of the kind of localized provincialism that we've seen in the past?
Well, I mean, it added a link that was going to be used for commercial purposes, also for recreation. I mean, I see there had been a tourism business here before the bridge, but it could explode after that. I mean, that's continued to grow over time. That I'd say is one of the big areas of impact. But again, clearly commercially, I see that as it added another link. We've already talked about water transportation. We've talked about rail. It was not an isolated area before, but this allowed trucking of a much larger size to have easier access to the shore. So clearly the bridge, and then it's the addition of the second span in the 1970s, that just made it that much easier to have access to markets, but also to other people, right? To other people either coming here and settling here or coming here to visit. And that's just sort of an inescapable fact of history.
Zach, I want to turn to you because we're now going to be celebrating, certainly the county's going to be celebrating the 150th anniversary. Tell us a little bit about the impetus for it, what kind of thinking is going on behind the kinds of events that you guys are going to have in terms of marking this serious event.
So we're really excited to be able to participate in sort of commemorating this huge milestone, you know, as it pertains to the county and the formation of the county. And thank you for that excellent background. That was awesome to learn a little bit. So, that was great. And, you know, I guess I'll preface it by saying 3 years ago when we started the Wicomico County Fair as we know it today, our primary, I guess, underlying motivation was to simply figure out a way to highlight a lot of the different activities that had maybe been diminished because of competition with things like the travel industry in Ocean City. You know, once upon a time, we had a lot of community festivals. We had a lot of summertime cookout type, you know, parties and celebrations that were going on here in Wicomico County. And just like anything else, we're now, you know, we're competing with travel. We're competing with all of the beach towns and resorts that we have here locally. So we wanted to figure out a way to bring together the Old Chicken Festival, which had a lot of heritage and a lot of success here, especially on the Lower Shore, as we began hosting it 7 to 10 years ago on Lower Delmarva. And then there was the Wicomico Farm and Home Show, which is an organization that is in its 81st year this year. And they, for a long time, used to host the Wicomico Farm and Home Show there at the old Civic Center. Before, you know, the building that we know now and love and use for a lot of community events. And then it was moved to Winter Place Park. And, you know, we've always had the component of the agricultural awareness, and we've always had that participation. So there's been your livestock entries and your indoor entries and sort of your competitive entries that have more of a rural or agricultural feel to it. But as you guys have alluded to in your discussion, we also have this bustling sort of urban area here with Salisbury, and there's a lot of focus in the last 5 years or so about the downtown revitalization. And I think sometimes we all struggle in this community to figure out ways to tie the two together because we're all residents of Wicomico County, whether you live in the city limits or whether you live on the outskirts of the county and maybe share a boundary line with some of those neighboring counties you discussed earlier. So We were approached this year by Wicomico County Council and Recreation, Parks, and Tourism, and they were really, really excited to celebrate the 150th anniversary for Wicomico County, and they were trying to, I guess, identify opportunities that they had with either ongoing events or the opportunity to develop a new event to commemorate this. And I jumped right at that opportunity as the chairperson of the fair. And I thought, what a better way. You know, the fair is already sort of challenged with promoting the lifestyle and the agriculture and the culture in general that we appreciate here on the Lower Eastern Shore. And this felt like the perfect way to bring everybody together under that 150th umbrella and celebrate local business, celebrate the community, especially the nonprofits, the clubs and organizations that help to drive a free event like a county fair. So it just seemed like a natural fit. And specifically, two of the things that are new additions to the county fair will be the Parade of Towns, which there's 12 delegations, townships, communities that we've identified. Of course, we went for any municipality or any incorporated area in Wicomico County. But then we've also pulled in some heritage groups and some other folks that are going to participate. So in addition to the parade, which will be going on Saturday, August 19th at 1:50 to commemorate the 150th celebration, we're also going to have something that we're calling our heritage tent or our heritage site there at the county fairgrounds. So it'll be close to the entertainment. It'll be close to the carnival where there will be a lot of foot traffic and people have easy access to it. But essentially, we've opened the doors and we've said any heritage organizations, any Ruritan clubs, any local municipalities who want to come and showcase either old memorabilia or they want to provide literature about the history of Wicomico County and their respective neighborhood or community, we've welcomed all of them with open arms. So those are really, really, I think, important additions to the fair this year. And then, of course, the county is sponsoring performers and doing things like that in addition to our fireworks that are all going to be a celebration of that 150th anniversary. But when you speak about the culture and sort of a way to promote that specifically and that heritage, I think those additions to the fair are most exciting.
Because, well, one of the things that I've noticed, certainly for Salisbury, but I suppose the county in general, is that there seems to be a lot more activity. We mentioned, I guess, in this program some weeks ago, there's going to be the National Folklife Festival. It's going to be coming here next year, actually be here for 3 years. And then, but there will also, as I understand, as part of the deal for them coming in, we're supposed to then continue this on, yep, on a local basis. What can you tell us anything about how you see that going forward?
Yeah, so the folk festival was really great news to me because I think it sort of resonates with the type of family fun oriented free event that we want to have here with the fair. That folk festival is going to do a great job to put Salisbury sort of on in a national spotlight when it comes to the folks that enjoy that kind of music and those types of events. And from what I understand, that's correct. We get to host the national festival here for 3 years, with the agreement that for perpetuity, we will continue to have a folk festival. So I know that with all the work that's going on downtown with the Riverwalk, for example, and some of the major projects and renovations that are going on, I'm not exactly sure, because I'm not on the committee for the folk festival, how the footprint of that's going to look or how the scope of that event is going to be sort of controlled and how logistically they're going to make that work. But I know that it's a challenge that they welcome with open arms. And I think the folk festival will be something that we can add to our list of summer activities or fall activities that we can all begin to enjoy and hopefully see for many generations to continue.
Just in organizing these things, I mean, we're focused on the city of Salisbury because that's where most of this stuff is taking place. Do the outer towns, do you think, might sometimes get a little lost in all of this? I mean, when I drive around, for example, I mean, I'll see like, oh, there's the fireman's thing over in Hebron, or there's at Pittsville, whatever it is. It almost seems like there's sort of this disparate, all these disparate events that are going, and obviously they want to celebrate their own particular heritage, but is there a way to pull all that together, or is this one way to do it in terms of the celebration?
Yeah, so I think the celebration in itself, and with us identifying those two activities, the Parade of Towns and the Heritage Tent or the Heritage Site on the grounds, I think that was really a way to hopefully break down some of those barriers that those, I don't want to call them outer municipality, or, that those neighborhoods and those communities feel, because I have to agree. I mean, we recognize that the downtown center, and just because of all the administrative buildings and with it being the county seat, we recognize that there's going to be a natural draw for business and for commerce and for activities. But I know, and I can only speak on behalf of the few organizations that I was present when we reached out to, I know that they were very, very appreciative of the fact that the county thought of them in addition to thinking of the folks downtown in the city of Salisbury. And I'm paraphrasing and I'm using my own words, but I feel like those folks do feel left out sometimes when it comes to planning these events and being able to showcase and celebrate their heritage. Because if they're not doing a carnival of their own or a cookout of their own or a fundraiser of their own, it's often not publicized and it just doesn't have the same, I guess, catalyst to drive attendance and to drive participation that city events do. So I think the fair, you know, we do a good job at reaching our rural-based residents in Wicomico County, simply because a county fair encapsulates all of the qualities of life that those people are able to enjoy and are afforded because of their lifestyle, you know, because of living in an area where they have a little more land, they have a little more access to natural resources, there's a little more time and space available for recreation. So the county fair, it's always been our mission to highlight that. So we have hundreds of animals that are brought in from children who live outside of city limits in a lot of instances. And then we have thousands of entries when it comes to photography and artwork and quilting and baked goods and fruits and vegetables that are all competitively judged. And, you know, they're awarded a nominal premium, but I don't think that's why people come to do it. They come to showcase what it is they enjoy about life on the Lower Eastern Shore. And as we all know in this room, there's a lot going on outside of the city limits of Salisbury. So the county fair seems like a great way to showcase all of that.
County fair is when?
It's August 18th, 19th, and 20th this year. And that's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So hopefully nobody will have trouble finding us. We're located right in Winter Place Park off of Hobbs Road, close to the Shorebird Stadium.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Creston Long. He's director of the NAB Center. Also, Zach Evans, chair of the Wicomico County Fair. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Many photographic images will grace the Ward Museum's Art and Nature Photo Festival this Friday. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Salisbury University's Ward Museum opens its exhibition this weekend with stunning views of nature from professional and amateur photographers alike, from birds in flight to landscapes. The festival celebrates the Eastern Shore. In our studio this morning, we have Shana Atkins. She's director of special events at the Ward Museum. And also by phone, we have award-winning photographer Jay Fleming. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me first start with the festival. Shana, tell us a little bit about the festival. How many photos are there, and how did this photo festival originate?
So the festival is in its seventh year. There's roughly 1,000 photos on display at the museum through the weekend. We have artists from all across the country mailing in their photos, and it's just a really great time, great festival. It's beautiful.
So, and what kinds of photos do we have? What kind of range do we have?
So the photos can range. We have amateur, professional, and we also have a youth category. And the categories range from birds, plants, and animals, landscapes, black and white, macro, micro. So really, I mean, just about anything you can find in nature can send us a photo.
So Jay, I want to turn to you and explain. You're a renowned photographer, National Geographic, and so on. How did you get interested in photography? I understand that from reading some of your bio that you kind of discovered it at an early age.
Yeah, I started shooting pictures when I was about 13 years old, right here on the Delmarva Peninsula. And my father, Kevin Fleming, who's also participated in the festival in the past, he's been a photographer in Delaware for over 40 years, and he was a major influence on me in my early years. And then recently I've kind of branched off on my own and started shooting stuff along the Chesapeake Bay, which is where I grew up. I grew up in Annapolis, Maryland. And most recently, I turned my lens to the working watermen of the Chesapeake Bay and, you know, documenting how they make a living on the water. And I recently published a book called Working the Water, which kind of is an all-encompassing vignette of the seafood industry and, you know, how people make a living off the resources of the bay.
So what was it? Yeah, let me ask you this. So when you first started, what really intrigued you the most about photography?
So for me, when I first started shooting, photography was kind of a motivation to get out and explore. And really in my early years, I was primarily shooting wildlife on the coastal bays of Delmarva, you know, from Rehoboth Bay all the way south to the Virginia Barrier Islands. But photography was really the motivation for me to get out and explore and, you know, learn about what was in the environment where I grew up. And, you know, I did a lot of wildlife photography, you know, visiting these islands where these birds nest. We have an incredible abundance of birds on the Delmarva Peninsula. And it really was a wonderful place for me to learn about photography and to learn about different lighting and, you know, timing and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Now, I understand, by the way, that you also did some photography in Yellowstone National Park. What was that like, and how did that contrast the kind of photography that you do on the Eastern Shore?
So Yellowstone was quite a different environment for me. I worked out there for the Park Service, operating a boat for them in 2011, 2012. And it was, you know, you would think that I was landlocked out there, but I was actually on Yellowstone Lake, which is a huge body of water. And, you know, I spent a lot of time out on the water there, but it was different. You know, they didn't have like tides out there like we do here. And just the whole environment, like the terrain was extremely different from Delmarva, but it was a beautiful place to work and to live for 2 summers. And, you know, I did a lot of underwater photography out there, and I was able to bring a lot of techniques and, you know, things that I learned out there back here to the Chesapeake Bay. And I also focus a lot on shooting, you know, shooting images that would tell a story while I was out there, because I was working on this interesting program with the Park Service. We were catching non-native lake trout in Yellowstone Lake as an effort to suppress their population levels to bring back the cutthroat trout. And, you know, I kind of turned my lens towards that conservation message. And that was a really, you know, interesting thing for me to document out there. And the pictures became very, you know, they became more than just beautiful pictures. They became very useful. And those shots ended up getting published by National Geographic when I returned from, when I returned from Yellowstone. And, you know, that was kind of a defining moment for my photography, because it really, you know, showed me how my pictures could be used for a conservation message and a storytelling message as well.
Yeah, by the way, when you were out there, any particular shot or series of shots that really stand out to you?
I did a lot of photographs of these spawning cutthroat trout in the Lamar River, which was quite amazing. The cutthroat trout out in Yellowstone are still pretty abundant, but they're not as abundant as they were since the introduction of lake trout. But they run up in these streams and rivers to spawn, just kind of like salmon. And the numbers of them are incredible. And I was able to you know, do a bunch of snorkeling and underwater photography with these fish. And, you know, also document the importance of these fish to other creatures for food. Like I was able to shoot pictures of these otters eating cutthroat trout that were spawning, which was a pretty amazing thing to see.
But then now, obviously, you're moving around, and then in that territory, in Ansel Adams kind of territory. Did you ever think about him when you were out there?
Absolutely, yeah. The landscapes were quite amazing. But really, I wanted to focus on something that people hadn't done out there, and that was the underwater photography. There wasn't much underwater photography out there, and I was trying to create unique images, because in Yellowstone there are a ton of photographers, and you know, for me, I always look for ways to differentiate my images from other photographers. So the underwater wildlife was my main focus.
So as a matter of fact, just Ansel Adams, of course, was in that era of black and white photography. We're now, of course, in the era of not only color photography, but digital photography as well. Did you experiment at all with black and white? And B, how do you see the contrast, the difference in the two mediums?
With black and white, like film and digital, or
black and white and color. Black and white as opposed to color, yeah.
Well, black and white is definitely very different from color. You know, when you're shooting, you're looking for different things. You're looking for, you know, more contrast. You're looking for shapes, and you're looking for textures. You know, with digital, or excuse me, with color, you're looking for those vibrant colors, you know, saturated colors, that type of thing. So you're looking for different elements of your image that will help, you know, display your subject the best.
Now, you obviously, go ahead.
As far as film goes, you know, shooting with film, that's what I started with when I was 13 years old. And I feel like that kind of gave me a unique background in the photography, because I was kind of right on the edge of the film and digital switchover. And I was able to, you know, get in on that at an early age. And shooting with film, you know, you were limited to 36 exposures. And now with digital, you can go out and shoot hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures in one outing. And, you know, you don't have that restriction of, you know, 36 shots per roll. And it's definitely changed the way that photographers shoot. Digital revolution.
Do you, by the way, do you think there's any difference in the images?
Definitely a big difference in image quality. You know, a trained eye can tell the difference immediately between a film shot and a digital shot. I think film images have a very nice aesthetic appeal. You know, kind of got a grainier feel, looks a little bit older. The colors are a bit different. And I still actually shoot with film for that reason. I shoot with black and white film just as kind of a personal thing that I do. And it kind of, the black and white kind of adds like a nostalgic feel to an image, kind of a timeless feel in a sense.
Now, you came back here to shoot a lot of photography in terms of the Eastern Shore.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like coming back to a much different environment than say the West? I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I was out Yellowstone and some of the big sort of the open sky kind of really of territory that the West is. When you come here, the world seems a little more confined because there's just a lot more things around you.
Yeah, it is when you're on the land, but you know, when you get on the water and when you get on the marshes, you know, the world kind of opens up, and that's primarily where I focus my my shooting efforts, is on the water and, you know, on these landscapes that are a little bit more open. And for me, coming back, like, I really couldn't wait to get back from Yellowstone to start shooting here. I mean, I just love being on the Chesapeake Bay and being on the water. And it's just, you know, I'm very lucky that I'm able to live here and work here and shoot on the water here.
Do you find that there are more things to shoot here than, say, in the West?
I think so. I think there's a little bit more going on culturally out here than in the West. But, you know, I didn't spend as much time shooting out there as I do here. But really, the more that I get out here and the more that I shoot, the more I learn and the more I find that I want to pursue as far as photography. With my book, Working the Water, when I started shooting this book in 2013, I really didn't know much about the seafood industry. And, you know, the more I got out, the more I talked to people, the more networking that I did, the more I learned. And, you know, the more inspired I became to pursue it and, you know, dig deeper and deeper into the subject matter.
How important do you think it is when you're shooting something like that to really understand the culture, the people that you're shooting, to get the kind of image that you want?
I think it's extremely important. It's almost just as important as, you know, getting out and shooting. Understanding your subject will help you shoot better images.
And any stand out to you of the people that you shot there on the water?
Well, in particular, I did a lot of shooting for the book, and I still do a lot of shooting on Smith Island and Tangier Island. And, you know, understanding that, like, cultures like that are so unique, you know, being able to interact with the people and being able to, you know, explore the subject in the right way, I think, you know, definitely makes a huge difference in your photography. As a rule of thumb, I tell people that, you know, 1 hour shooting should equal 1 hour research before you go out shooting. So, you know, spending time thinking about what you're shooting, thinking about your approach, how you're going to shoot it, thinking about what light you're going to use, that's all very important. That's all stuff that, you know, people should think about before they actually go out shooting to kind of maximize their effort when they're out there.
And how important is it to try to create a rapport, as it were, with the subject? And how do you go about doing that, especially for people that you don't necessarily know well? They may come from a culture or community that perhaps is not as receptive or might look upon you with maybe just a slight certain apprehension or thoughtfulness about who you are and how you relate to them. How do you break into that in that rapport?
Well, it can take a while, and it did take me a while to get in with the seafood industry. But, you know, over time, people became aware of what I was doing and what my intentions were. And, you know, as a photographer and as a photojournalist, you really have to approach your subject matter objectively if you want to maintain access to the subject. And, you know, you really don't want to bring any images across, bring any opinions across through your images, but let people make their opinions through your images. So being objective is very important.
Do you withhold maybe some judgment or try to erase some kind of prior judgment in terms of trying to relate to these people then?
Absolutely. I kind of come to the table with an open mind, and I just, you know, I like to listen to people before I make opinions, and, you know, understand both sides of the story before making a judgment. And, you know, with my images and what I write about my images and what I put out there on the social media or into my books, that type of thing, you know, I describe it as just, you know, documenting what's happening, not creating a subjective opinion.
By the way, now, in terms of shooting, particularly some of the captains and some of the sea people, Waterman, any particular person stand out? I thought I saw a picture of Sonny Whitelock. I might be wrong about that, but
yeah.
It certainly looked like him. Any people stand out?
With the cigarette in his mouth.
Exactly. Yes, I saw that. I said, I know that guy. Yes. Any stand out like Stoney or other people or what?
Well, Stoney's, you know, obviously a great guy, and he's a huge proponent of the skipjacks and the oyster industry. Another great person from Deal Island is Art Daniels. He actually just passed a few months ago, but Art was the main inspiration for my book, Working the Water. He was 93 years old when he stopped working. He was running the skipjack city of Chrisfield, but Art was incredibly inspirational for my book. He opened a lot of doors for me with different people on Deal Island, which eventually led to getting out on the water with people all over the bay. Because it's really amazing you know, how some of these people who work in the water, they really know people up and down the Chesapeake Bay. It's a really strong community, and it's really incredible to see that in this day and age where, you know, I feel like a lot of people, especially in Annapolis, Baltimore, you know, different areas like that, they don't really understand where the community where they're living or the culture where they're living. But, you know, people who work on the water, they've got a long history of, you know, I don't know how you would say it, but they've got a long history of understanding the people that live around them.
They also struck me, by the way, as extremely independent. I said this the other day to somebody that they're coming from the West, they remind me actually of the cowboy in the sense that, you know, the cowboy's got his horse and herd, and the waterman's got, you know, his crew and his boat, as it were. I mean, it seems they're very, I mean, could you really capture that kind of sense of independence and self-reliance that you often see from some of these folks?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of these guys are very independent. You know, they really wouldn't want to work for somebody else and have like a real boss, so to speak. They're out there on their own terms, on their own hours, and that's not saying that it's not a lot of hard work. It's probably even harder work than working for somebody else and, you know, coming to work and sitting at a desk, so to speak. But, you know, a lot of these guys are very independent and, you know, wouldn't have it any other way.
Any particular
in terms of like relating it to like cowboys in the West, I think the two are probably very similar in the sense that they're both, you know, they're working off the land, they're working off the water, that type of thing.
And if,
so they really are kind of salt of the earth.
Any particular shot, by the way, from that those photos that stand out to you?
There's one shot from working the water. It's in the winter gill netting chapter. It's of a waterman named Eddie Cummings from Tillman Island, and his entire face is like covered in ice. And we were out gill netting in the shipping channel off Tillman, and weather was really rough, and that image to me just kind of shows like what these guys go through and what it takes in order for them to make a living. Like, they're out, you know, on the worst of days, fishing, oystering, et cetera. And, that's just to be able to pay their bills, to support their family, and to be able to bring that seafood to our tables.
I want to turn, by the way, to the wildlife here on the shore. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to shoot wildlife? I mean, wildlife are moving targets. I mean, I did some photography in my younger years, which did a lot of, still life. And one of the things that struck me is that unlike still life, you can't say, move the bird somewhere. it's wherever it is. How do you figure out how to position yourself when you come upon a photograph, and how much do you anticipate what you're going to be seeing?
Well, my approach with wildlife photography is to really pick a location and pick a subject. And usually the location is an area where I know I can find that particular subject. So, for example, with birds, Delmarva has an incredible variety of birds that live in and around the Chesapeake Bay. And, some of these islands out, like Smith and Tangier Island or Hollins Island, are really great spots to find these birds, in particular in the spring, summer, and fall. And actually with the Ward Museum, after the keynote speech that I'm giving on Friday, I'm taking out 10 photographers to Smith Island, and we're going to be exploring the marshes and creeks of the island, and primarily trying to find some birds, in particular pelicans, which are nesting out on Smith Island.
Any, by the way, any particular bird you favor over any others in terms of shooting, or anything that stands out for you?
I really enjoy shooting egrets and herons. I think we have a huge variety of egrets and herons on Delmarva, and some of them are just incredibly beautiful, really elegant birds.
Now, and finally, when you're out there and you're shooting, I mean, what are, in terms of your mental state, are you sort of in this zone, in this quiet place? What's the mindset like when you're actually out there shooting and doing that kind of photography?
Yeah, usually I'm trying to be relatively quiet, not move around a lot. When you're shooting wildlife, you want to kind of blend into their environment as much as possible and be as unintrusive as possible. So you're going to want to be quiet. You're going to want to wear clothing with, somewhat dull colors like camouflage, and just kind of blend into the bird's environment and, just be an observer of what they're doing, basically.
Do you shut everything else out except that visual component?
Yeah, absolutely. Just kind of position yourself according to where you think the light's going to be the best, and just kind of try to blend in as well as possible.
So I've noticed that I think you mentioned that there are sort of three things, I think, that you've talked about in terms of for photography. One is patience, preparation, and researching potential opportunities. Explain a little bit about those and how you came to the conclusion that these are really the elements that you need in order to produce some good photography.
Well, we'll start with the research portion, because that's usually the first portion that kind of comes into play. Like I said, an hour of research is equivalent to an hour of time in the field. And just, refining your way of approach to the subject and thinking about it before you actually go out will help you take better pictures and will help you, you know, maximize your effort when you're out there. And the patience, you know, patience getting out there, patience waiting for the right light, and, you know, not getting discouraged if it doesn't happen the first time. You might have to go out a second time or a third time, and that's happened to me. For example, shooting for my book, there were certain fisheries that I went out and, you know, shot three or four times before I really got what I wanted. But, you know, I wasn't discouraged, and you never know when you're going to get the right image. It could happen instantly, right when you get to your shooting location, or it could take hours or days. And then, you know, execution would be the final step. And, you know, knowing how to properly use your camera and, you know, use your settings as well as possible to get the best images that you can. That's the final step. And, you know, usually the execution portion happens really quickly, but you have to be able to know how to use your camera when you need to. Otherwise, you know, all that work into the preparation, the patience, et cetera, is not going to be worth your time.
Just quickly, by the way, so we haven't talked about printing. Is this just a matter then of finding the right shot and then simply printing as opposed to doing anything to the photograph itself?
Well, as far as printing goes, you know, and well, I should say printing and displaying your work, you really need to, there's multiple steps involved. You really need to be able to, like, edit your images down to select the ones that you want to display and select what images are going to be best for the purpose that which you're displaying. For example, for my book, Working the Water, I took 330,000 pictures in 3 years on hundreds of different shoots. And for my book, I published 300 images from those 330,000. So an incredible amount of work went into editing those images, you know, editing them down, calling them, so to speak. And, you know, once I had called them down to the images that were going to make it into the book, we had to, you know, retouch them and, you know, kind of like bring out the contrast or adjust the saturation, so to speak. But yeah, that's a whole nother process. And then printing them is an entirely different process as well. So there's a lot involved. You know, it's not just going out and clicking the shutter. There's a lot involved before you do that, and then there's a lot involved after you do that.
Shane, I want to just turn to you one more time. So the event takes place this coming Friday. Tell us a little again about real quickly.
So registration is Friday morning. The doors open at 10 a.m. or 10 to 3. You can walk in with your photos, and we'll walk you step by step through the registration process. And then following registration, Jay's keynote is from 6 to 9. It's $5 for non-members, and our members are free. And then the next day, we'll open up with seminars. Jay's workshop is going to be taking place that morning. Some food. We'll have a good weekend.
Okay. We're talking to Shana Atkins. She's director of special events, the Ward Museum. Also, Jay Fleming, award-winning photographer, National Geographic, amongst others. And Jay, we appreciate you joining us by phone there. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.